first case this morning is United States v. McPherson, and this is a certified case, so United States is the appellant, and we'll go for it. Is the United States prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
And McPherson?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. The government may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Williams, along with Captain T.J. Dharmafar, represent the United States. Chief Judge Stuckey, may I have 2 minutes for rebuttal, please?
Granted.
The Military Justice Act of 2016 ushered in a multitude of changes to the Uniform Code. One of those changes was not a sudden and drastic curtailment of the statute of limitations for child abuse offenses committed under prior versions of the code. Read in their appropriate context, in the light of the legislation, the changes is plainly evident that Congress did not retroactively shorten the limitation period for child abuse victims. Accordingly, the decision of the Army Court of Criminal Appeals should be overturned for three principal reasons. The first is the legislation brought forth by the Military Justice Act of 2016 is not intended to be applied retroactively to change the historic lexicon of what constitutes a child abuse offense. Second, if this court were to find a retroactive application, appellee's crimes nonetheless constitute child abuse offenses. And should this court find retroactivity and that it constitutes, does not apply, that would result in such an absurd result contrary to the express intent of Congress and defeat the very purpose of the legislation, that the court should eschew such an interpretation. And lastly, Appellee did not raise this at trial, and all of this is subject to plain error analysis. Turning to retroactivity. When you look at the legislation in a whole, you see that the Military Justice Act of 2016 brought forth many changes to include redesignation and structure of the punitive articles themselves. You see that maiming moves from Article 128 to, or 124. You see that kidnapping moves from 134 to 125. Sodomy of a child is eliminated entirely under Article 125 because it's captured in Article 120 Bravo. Assault with specified intent moved from Article 134 to Article 128. Because of these structural changes in just the ordering and the numbering of the punitive articles, Article 43 itself has to be conformed. And conformed to the structure that the code will look like on January 1, 2019. And Congress evidenced this express intent when in Section 5225 Delta, it lists conforming and then specifies what the conforming amendment is. That conforming amendment cannot take place or have any meaning until January 1, 2019, because it refers to a version of the code that will not exist until the President fully brings forth the changes directed by the Military Justice Act of 2016. That is the context. When you read the entire statute as a whole and parse it together, then you see that this retroactivity of this list of offenses simply was not meant to be. And conforming amendments are not to be given substantive effect.
Well, that's a catch line. And we've held that catch lines have no effect.
This is a legislative instruction manual. So when you look at...
I know something about legislation. I spent 20 years doing it. Catch lines don't have a substantive effect. Now, you can say it's a conforming amendment, and conforming amendments usually aren't supposed to do X. But sometimes Congress does something and then looks back on it and says, oh, did we do that? Couldn't this be one of those cases?
I do not believe so, Chief Justice Stuckey. Because when you have to look at everything that was going on in the Military Justice Act of 2016.
There were a lot of moving parts.
There's many moving parts. And we are to interpret statutes not based on isolated provisions, but on the context of the legislation as a whole.
Well, what does this isolated provision mean then? Application. These amendments shall apply for prosecution of any offense committed before, on, or after the date of the enactment of the subsection, if the applicable limitation period does not yet expire. And what could that possibly mean other than all those amendments you just read off are intended to be retroactive?
When you look at Article 43 historically, as it relates to the increase or the enhancement of limitation of statute of limitations to childhood suspensions, you have the first part that says what the elongated period is. And then you also have a description through a list of offenses to help define and otherwise guide what offenses that limitation should be applied to. That the 5225 box card is just saying you have to have the definition and use that definition. To the extent that there's any incongruity between the 5225 Delta, noting that it is a conforming amendment, and Foxtrot, that's where reading the legislation together brings the intent of Congress to the forefront.
Right, you want us to ignore the plain text of that provision, right? Because you think it's inconsistent with the Congress intention and what they were trying to do, right? I completely understand that. But for us to ignore that, there's got to be ambiguity. What is the other possible meaning of this provision that we could adopt and ignore what the appellee says it means?
I don't think the government's asking for you to ignore anything. Because we look at the legislative instruction manual as to 5225 Delta, and we see that it's conforming the code to what it's going to look like on January 1, 2019. Because if you make that conforming amendment effective on December 23, 2016, to the extent that is the date of enactment is the effective date in this provision, you now have the definition being skewed to crimes that are not chargeable for 2 years.
On that point, I think you have a good point on that, which is, you know, for example, all those new crimes that are listed in Romanet I through Romanet IV, you're right. I mean, those didn't exist yet. But what about the earlier language in 5225 Delta? Subsection B2B of subsection article is amended by striking clauses Romanet I through Romanet V and inserting the following new clause. Well, you're right that making that new clause retroactive wouldn't make sense. But what would be the argument that you couldn't strike clauses Romanet I through Romanet V in the old law? Because there's no, that's just getting rid of those provisions.
Again, I think you look at the context of what is happening. This the striking I through V to replace the I through
O. Well, I understand that, but I just don't see how we can say that Congress was unable to strike those provisions, because there wasn't any. Even if the other provisions couldn't go into effect in 2019, you could strike anything you want in 2016.
But that would also require the court to find that the Congress struck little I through little IV from the 2006 version, and then replace it with nothing.
True, I agree.
Because if you replace it with I through little IV, again, that's going to refer to crimes that don't exist. Such as in 2006, Article 120 Bravo was not a crime. So we've inserted some kind of logical inconsistency into the very law itself. Especially whenever you see in 5225 Alpha, Congress intended to increase the limitation period, or to enhance the limitation period for child abuse offenses. Further, to go ahead and use the do. And I think
I was there at the creation of this thing when they first enacted 120. They took it out of a California state statute, the House put it in. It was a mess then. It's been a mess ever since. To say that this is some pristine miracle of drafting is silly. It's replete with problems. It has been replete with problems from the beginning. And simply to come up here and say, well, well, if I was in Canada and whether they did it or not, we should swallow that. In the context of Article 120, is pretty on dangerous ground.
Understood, Your Honor. Though I would note that, again, we're trying to interpret the statute and not isolated provisions. Again, when you look at the application of 5225 Foxtrot, it also requires both a temporal and a linguistic incongruity. Because for that a provision to work retroactively, which appears 5225 Foxtrot was aimed at the issue identified in Lopez de Victoria, you would have to first find that an offense is not a child abuse offense, apply the statute, and then negate it and find that it is not a child abuse offense.
But the statute gives us the definition of child abuse offenses. It's not hard to figure out whether an offense is in the definition or not. It gave us an express list.
So if this court were to find that the list of offenses is applied retroactively, and that for a two-year period of time, that assault with intent to commit murder for a child committed on December 24, 2016 is subject to only a five-year limitation period, whereas a simple assault under 128 is to an enlarged period of time, that defeats the very purpose of the statute. But if that's where the court finds, because of 5225 Foxtrot, appellee's crimes nonetheless constitute child abuse offenses.
Mr. Conway, before you get to that part of your argument, I confess I do not have the background in legislative activity, the ins and outs of what Congress did, but it seems like your argument is that you're not asking us to ignore the language in the statute. It appears that you're making this distinction, correct me if I'm wrong, that the conforming amendments are not substantive, and therefore were not subject. They weren't really the same kind of amendments in other parts of the statute that would be subject to the retroactivity provision. Now, I understand that, but is that based on the premise that conforming amendments always act like this? I mean, this is how you treat conforming amendments all the time? You may not know either, but, because I assume you haven't been elected to office either.
No, no, Your Honor.
But you see what I'm asking, right? So I don't know if this is how conforming amendments generally operate, because that's one question I'll ask. My other question is, in this case, would it have been easier and made more sense if Congress had said in the conforming amendments that these conforming amendments do not go into effect until the President decides when they're going to be effective, i.e. 1 January 2019? I know that's what you're arguing, right? But what, could they just say that? And we'd all be kind of not, I could be out there playing golf or doing something else. But, so those are the two questions I have.
So your first question, it would be disingenuous for the government to say that conforming amendments never have substantive effect. There are Supreme Court cases that say as much. However, in Cyan, Inc., the Supreme Court wrote that they are supposed to have no substantive effect. So you have to look at the purpose, the scope, and the context of the legislation. And in this particular case, you see that the purpose of the legislation is to enlarge the limitation period. And it's very clear what that conforming amendment is supposed to go to. It's talking about the numerical designations given to crimes. And those numerical designations are going to change 2 years in the future. So you have to conform the list to what the manual will look like prospectively going forward. So in this particular case, given all of that fidelity in the statute itself, there is no, it counsels against a substantive finding that the conforming amendment was supposed to be made retroactive.
The counter, of course, is that, hey, look, and I think Judge Hardy was alluding to this, the problem is the conforming amendments are so detailed, and you would have thought that, you know, with all of this detail that they're coming up with, that they would go out of their way to say, wait a minute, I know we just said that these amendments are retroactive, but these conforming amendments are looking prospective.
Your Honor, I certainly wish that all legislation was written pristinely and clearly, though that might write me out of a job sometimes. But I think that the detail that's provided here actually cuts against retroactivity, because it cannot be said that the kidnapping of a child on December 21, 2016, and otherwise chargeable under Article 134, is not a child abuse offense. But you nab that same child 3 days later, and that is a child abuse offense. Again, it requires a semantic incongruity to find that something is first a child abuse offense has only been found that it is not.
Yeah.
Or temporally, that you must find that the limitation period has not expired, and then use the amendment to otherwise expire it. And the very legislation that Congress has said that we are trying to enhance the protection of children.
And so your position is that Congress didn't make an error here. It's not that they forgot to add Indecent Act as it pertains, as it was listed under Article 134. You're saying that's not a mistake on the part of Congress. You're saying that, hey, look, they're conforming the statute to what it's going to look like when the actual changes we talked about earlier in the statute, or in the statutory changes, take effect.
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe that there is, the government believes that there's plenty of evidence in the statute that allows for the reading it in context and not divorcing the provisions and reading them in isolation that allows for that result.
Counsel, if we were to write an opinion agreeing with you, what would we say the language of the applicable statute of limitations said? We say, well, there's a challenge on period of limitations at the relative time. This is what the statute of limitations said. What would we say?
I think that you would be able to cite the unremarkable proposition that the statute of limitations in effect at the time of the offense is what applies, and that we would go to the 2006 version of the manual, look at the list of offenses of what was a child abuse offense, and apply that to the appellant's malfeasance.
And we just say, even though 5225 Delta said that was stricter, we're still applying it.
In light of all of the legislation and reading the statute as a whole, I believe that is an appropriate reading of the legislation.
You only got 20 seconds. Could you address plain error?
In plain error, the error was certainly not plain and obvious to any of the litigants at trial. This was not raised until appeal. And as the government has noted, the provision is not supposed to be read retroactive. His offenses, nonetheless, the touching of her vulva with his penis is a child abuse offense then, now, and forevermore. And the absurdity of the result just could not be found plainly evident. So therefore, the appellee was going to play an error review.
Judge Hart. What should we make of the fact that 12 months after Congress either did or didn't make this legislative mistake, they seem to have tried to fix their mistake, which seems to at least suggest that they're acknowledging that they made a mistake. And you're arguing that would have never been necessary. There's no need to go back and correct this because, you know, you're arguing it was obvious, it should have been clear what they intended to do and what they meant. So what do we make of the fact that 12 months later, Congress seems to have said, whoops, we didn't mean to do that, and they enacted legislation passed by the House, signed by the President, to fix what the appellee says was their mistake.
I think the clarifying amendment brought out in Section 531, November, it merely just says, when we say conforming, we meant conforming. And you apply the list of offenses as they existed on December 22nd, 2016, until the date enactment by the President, because frankly, the offenses that we gave you simply are inapplicable because they will not exist for 2 years. Any questions? The decision of the Army Courts is over, sir.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellee.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Alex Hess. Captain Joe Seaton and I represent the appellee, Staff Sergeant Danny McPherson. Your Honor, the amendments to Article 43 are clear and they are unambiguous. Congress deleted all Article 134 offenses from the enumerated list of child abuse offenses, and they made that change explicitly retroactive and effective immediately. The government throughout its argument has paid lip service to the textualist reading of the amendments, but it's clear, based on what we heard today, that the government is actually attempting to elevate what it thinks Congress intended over what the statute plainly says. And that is the antithesis of textualism.
Captain, what about the argument that they're making, the central argument that, hey, look, these are conforming amendments, and they have a list of cases that they rely on that seem to support that notion, that conforming amendments are not substantive. True, Congress could have said, made it more clear, for sure, but this notion that they made a mistake, they're rejecting that. The government is rejecting that notion. They're not saying you don't look at the plain language. Actually, he's saying you do look at the plain language. You look at the language of the conforming amendments and understand that they are just that. And that's why they are not substantive and were not subject to the retroactivity provisions of the Military Justice Act writ large.
Well, Your Honor, as the government acknowledged, it is not always the case that just because something is labeled as a conforming amendment, that it does not have substantive effect. That was Harrison versus PPG Industries, the Supreme Court held for that proposition. And it's clear from the amendments, and additionally, Your Honor, as Judge Stuckey noted, just because a title or a headline, as this court said in Lopez de Victoria, it's not part of the statute, it can't vary the plain meaning, it's available only when there's some ambiguity in the text. It cannot undo what the text makes plain. And here what Section 5225F makes plain is that Section 5225D, which is the change in the child abuse offense enumerations, is effective immediately. It is effective retroactively as well. Congress explicitly drew that line by including subsection D. That is what this applies to as well. So,
could you respond to the government's point on that, which is that it doesn't make sense to say that the amendment in 5225 Delta would apply retroactively because as 2016, some of those offenses were not yet offenses.
Some of the offenses. But some of the offenses were offenses. In Little I, for example, 120, 120 Bravo, all those offenses were existing. So there was effect for those. It's true that these, you know, maiming, kidnapping, were not going to actually be punitive under those articles until January 1st, 2019. But that doesn't mean that just because those articles weren't immediately in effect, that Congress did not want this to apply retroactively when they made that very clear in the statute. And regardless of when this amendment actually went into effect, the very nature of making it retroactive, it makes it irrelevant that Congress is trying to pass this to conform to a future version of the code. When they say it's...
Can I stop you for just a minute again? I'm a little confused. You don't take... You agree that with the government's position that the offenses like kidnapping and the others that you listed would not... Obviously, they're offenses that are not going to be in existence for 2 years.
Right.
So it was plain there, but yet you're saying... With respect to other aspects of this conforming amendment, we shouldn't take that view.
But no, I'm saying that there are some of the offenses did exist at the time. And just because there's other offenses that aren't coming into effect immediately, doesn't mean that this is simply a conforming amendment that they're trying to make effective 2 years down the road.
Correct, but I thought your argument is that all of these conforming amendments are retroactive, and it goes back to what Judge Maggs just mentioned. Well, they all can't be retroactive because several of these offenses just don't exist yet at that time.
But, and It's correct that, I mean, the offenses don't exist at the time, but regardless of when time...
But also you have retroactivity for an offense that doesn't exist yet.
Well, as Judge Maggs noted, to strike the items on the list, that applies retroactively, as Congress said. Just because you retroactively may not apply to those lists of offenses has no bearing on the fact that 134 was removed. And that was removed applying retroactively, and that's what's before the court here. And clearly that is not ambiguous at all. In St. Cyr, INF versus St. Cyr, the Supreme Court said that the exact language that Congress used here, before, on, or after, is retroactivity. The government's entire argument is asking the court to ignore that language to say, I guess, that this is not retroactive at all. That we should disregard not only that, we should disregard the reference in subsection D that Congress explicitly included in subsection F. So the government is couching its arguments in terms of we have to look at it in context, but in reality, the government is asking this court to ignore the plain language that Congress put into this amendment, and that's something we simply cannot do.
Counsel, I think the government's most compelling argument is that if you polled all the congressmen and senators and you asked them, is the outcome in the CCA below, is that what you intended when you done this? You'd probably get a unanimous vote. No, that's not what you intended. So what is the best argument then that this outcome isn't, what is your best argument that this outcome is still required? Although I think the government makes a compelling case is that this is clearly not what Congress intended.
Well, again, when we analyze the statute, the first step is always what does the plain language say? And the plain language says what we said. What we say it says, which is, it was 134 was deleted, it was retroactive, it was effective immediately. Your question about intent, I guess, sort of touches on the absurdity doctrine, I think, which is, as the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, applies only in the most extreme cases, because you're essentially saying, we're not going to read what Congress wrote. They did not mean what they say. We think that the government has not reached the threshold to be able to invoke the absurdity doctrine in this case for several reasons. The first is, when we think about the absurdity doctrine, it is Congress could not possibly have intended this, and I think that's what you're saying, Your Honor.
Do you agree with that notion? That Congress couldn't have intended this outcome?
No. I certainly think it's possible that Congress foresaw this happening. And I said that because they included legacy provisions in Section 5225D. They continue to include Article 120 in there. That has not been used to prosecute child offenses since 2012. So Congress keeping striking that and then reinserting that back in appears to have recognized that when we're making this statute retroactive, we have to continue to include these legacy provisions that are in there because of the nature of retroactivity. The fact that they kept 120 in purposely but removed 134 seems to indicate that it's certainly possible Congress foresaw the consequences of making something retroactive and not continuing to include these legacy offenses. And having foreseen that, they proceeded nonetheless.
What are the other reasons that you had for why the absurdity doctrine should not be invoked here?
Well, I think the other thing is what the Supreme Court recently said in Brakes, and that is when legislators draft statutes of limitations, we presume that they do so in an attempt to be clear and straightforward. And if we've seen anything over the last 15 years, it's that statute of limitations have changed repeatedly. Punitive articles have changed repeatedly. It's become a mess. And
why doesn't that count against you? Why doesn't the fact that this has become a very complicated area for legislation indicate that, in fact, this was an error, whether you refer to it as a drafter's error or Scrivener's error or anything like that? Why doesn't the complexity of this area indicate that, in fact, Congress did not intend this?
Well, I think, again, we're talking about the absurdity doctrine when we're talking about Congress's intent. The fact that it had become so complex over time might be the very reason Congress decided to make these changes retroactive, because, in effect, they're clearing the field. They're saying these are the offenses with the extended statute of limitations and only these. And therefore, instead of having to flip through, you know, prior NDAAs, prior versions of the code, this is it. It's much simpler now. The way Congress has done it, because they made it retroactive for practice.
So why would Congress be interested in coming up with
a simple, elegant solution as compared to protecting victims of child sexual assault.
But all that matters, Your Honor, is that that could be a reason for what Congress did. And, Your Honor,
but you're saying, I just want to make sure I understand your point. You're saying that for ease of interpretation, that Congress would make this change?
That could be.
Kicking down the statute of limitations where they've been repeatedly ratcheting it up, and suddenly they say that this policy interest in making it simple overbears any concern about victims of child sexual abuse?
That could be one of the considerations that Congress had when it did this. And as long as there is a plausible reason for what Congress was doing, regardless of whether we disagree with it personally, we have to give that effect.
Whatever plausible reasons could there be? I was noting on bottom of page 25 and top of page 26 of your brief, I'm not sure if you wrote it or Captain Shudder, but there were two things that stuck out to me, if I could just go through it a little bit with you. You were saying that under Bostock, so it's the bottom 25 and top 26, that criminal defendants should be able to rely on the law as written, which is absolutely a perfectly understandable proposition. But then the brief says, this justification alone provides a non-absurd reason why Congress may have reduced the statute of limitations. Those two propositions don't match.
I think the point we were trying to communicate there, Your Honor, is as long as there is some non-absurd reason for what Congress was doing, whether this was it or whether it was for purposes of clarity or whether it was because Congress...
Okay, but you say whether this was it. Now, is simply that people should be able to rely on the law as written. So that doesn't fit into this idea that, therefore, this is why they wrote it that way. See what I mean?
Yes. I guess the point we're trying to say is, with this and with everything else, as long as you can't get into the heads of one legislator, let alone 535 legislators on Capitol Hill, as long as a rational person or there is a reasonable explanation for what Congress was doing, the absurdity doctrine cannot be met. They cannot cross that threshold for something to be absurd.
Okay, and then you go on to cite in your brief, you say, Congress may well have accepted anomalies such as this one, referring to the statute of limitations, in the name of providing a uniform system. Well, certainly there is an anomaly here when simple assault consummated by battery, you have a much longer statute of limitations than a decent act of minor. So there certainly is an anomaly here, but where is the evidence that that's what Congress wanted?
Well, that's precisely the problem, and that's why in Bostock and why the Supreme Court has really rejected the use of legislative history as an interpretive tool coming forward, because the legislative history, frankly, for the MJA of 16 is sparse. There's not much there at all. So we're having to, whenever we try to put ourselves in the head of legislators, we risk substituting our judgment for what they were possibly thinking.
And yet, we have the patron of textualism, Justice Scalia, who acknowledged and supported the idea of the absurdity doctrine. So, we're already out of the sphere of having to only take the absolutist position that the plain language must dictate the result. Now, obviously, there is a huge body of law out there that says it must only be done in the rarest and most exceptional circumstances. Here, why is this not one of those rare and exceptional circumstances?
Well, I think it is because, again, if we look at why would Congress leave Article 120 in there, in this legacy offense? They must have read. There's no reason to leave that in there.
The better question is, why would they reduce the statute of limitations?
But
that's the real issue. Not getting into the technicalities of what provisions they're citing. What would be the reason for Congress to reduce the statute of limitations, particularly in an instance here when the offense was committed, that statute still had not run? You're saying that Congress decided, without a bit of legislative history, or any public indication why, that they're going to reach down and say, in cases of this one, we are going to take away the ability of the government to prosecute this case. Why would that happen?
I think it's more that Congress was willing to accept the risk that something like this might happen. And for the sake of being precise and being clear in listing the enumerated child abuse offenses and making it retroactive,
they could have been precise and clear using other language. They could have simply inserted the correct provision here and had it covered. So it's not as if they're saying, well, there's no good way to do this, so we're going to divest the ability to prosecute some 10-year-old girl who has been sexually abused by a biological father.
It just appears that Congress was aware of what it was doing. It was aware that deleting the legacy provision would have this effect, and it nevertheless did that. And that we have to give that effect. And there are non-absurd reasons why some Congress people might have voted or decided to vote on this legislation on that basis, because they wanted to clear this mess, clear the field, and they were willing to accept the risk that, you know, some old offenses, and the statute was about to expire for this offense, some of those might fall away, but that is the cost we pay for being precise and for clearing the field and clearing this mess. That is a policy consideration Congress could have made. It's a non-absurd policy. We might disagree with it, but that's not our place. That's for the legislator to make that policy decision, and they've made that choice.
While we're talking about precision, in Article 43, when it tries to define child abuse offenses, it says an act that involves abusing a person of less than, you know, is not attained 16, and constitutes any of the following offenses. It's not a reading of articles. It's a sort of an actionable definition. Does that make any difference to your argument?
No, I think since 2003, Congress has said, these are the child abuse offenses. We're going to list them specifically by punitive article. By
okay, so this... If this is an attempt by Congress to rope back in stuff that somehow wiggled through the net, it doesn't overcome a list.
Correct.
Is what you're saying.
Correct. It is an enumerated list, Your Honor. There's no catch-all or
residual phrase. Right. Okay. So this, what you're saying is this language really doesn't have an effect as far as that's concerned. Which doesn't have an effect in pulling them back in the net.
Of the 134s, Your Honor.
Well, whatever situation.
No.
You know, some gets dropped from the list, it's dropped from the list.
Correct.
Regardless of this language in 43.
If Congress struck that and replaced the child abuse offenses with new references to punitive articles, yes, that 134 is not there. That's no longer on the list.
Well, I know that. That's what we're arguing.
Yes.
So what I'm asking is does this language have any effect, above and beyond the list?
Of the constitution and offense and violation?
Yeah, of violation of article da-da-da-da-da-da.
No, it's just clearly saying if this is the offense that is committed, that is a child abuse offense with this extended statute of limitations.
Well, I thought you were going somewhere, and now you seem to be back at home.
We might be ships crossing in the night.
Maybe we're ships crossing in the night, like the Doria and the Stockholm.
Yes, sir.
Don't you know what happened to them? Okay, thank you.
But that's a bit of a just plain error.
Yes, sir.
I mean, the government basically says, look, even if you're right, this is a new statute. There was no precedent interpreting it. It's counterintuitive, even if it's not absurd. The conforming amendment canon suggests maybe this doesn't apply retroactively. It's impossible to apply all of 5225 Delta retroactively because some of those offenses don't exist. And the CCAs are in conflict. How can we write an opinion saying this error was clear and obvious?
if we consider the fact that if the parties had opened Title 10 and looked at Article 43 as it existed in 2017 when the charges were received, they would have seen that opponent's offenses or Charlie McPherson's offenses were not on the list. That immediately that change occurred to Article 43. That should have set off a red flag. And as the D.C. Circuit has said in cases like In Re Shield case, where the statute is clear, as it was in this case, the error is plain as well. But in this case, uniquely, we don't even have to actually get to the question of plainness. And that's because in footnote 15, the Army Corps appeared to have dismissed this charge under its Article 66 authority as well. They said our analysis, we find that this is plain error, but it does not turn on the degree of accuracy of the error. Since there's any ambiguity there, it should be remanded to ACCA for the question of whether they dismissed this under Article 66 or not. But it seems evident from footnote 15, they took Article 66 power to get rid of this. When it comes to the lower courts conflicts, only two courts have addressed the core issue here, Adams and this court. And, Your Honor, I see my time is over.
Please answer the question.
Yes, thank you, sir. In reality, they both agreed that on its face the statute was unambiguous with respect to its retroactivity, its immediate effect. It's only that the Adams court improperly invoked the absurdity doctrine to go against the language of what Congress actually wrote. That doesn't make the statute any less clear. And certainly, if we drill it down even further, the only court to have actually addressed indecent acts is this court in McPherson. And they clearly said that this was plain error. So we have met the plain error standard, but ultimately we don't even have to get there, Your Honor, because of what the CCA did below.
Captain Hess, you had invoked Graves earlier.
Yes, sir.
So with Graves, we have statute of limitations in the area of sex offenses in the military justice system. This court goes through what we believe to be a tightly reasoned, logical progression and came up with the position that, in fact, statute of limitations had run. Supreme Court takes the case and in what essentially is a unanimous opinion says, not so fast, of course, it appeals to the armed forces. They say, reasonable minds may differ. We don't need to spend a long time on this, but when you look at the big picture and you use some common sense, it's clear that the statute had run here. Are there lessons we should learn from Briggs in terms of how we decide this case?
Yes, Your Honor. The first one, one of the things Briggs Court said is we presume that legislators are trying to be clear and straightforward when they legislate statutes of limitations in particular. And that's sort of when we were discussing earlier anonymous reasons, that might be something that very well that Congress was striving to do was to be clear. At the cost of being clear is always that an offense might fall away, and that they were willing to accept that risk. The other thing that the Supreme Court said in Briggs is it actually rejected the attempt by Briggs to use the dictionary to define what was punishable. The government's brief talked about how we should look to the dictionary, for example, when we're interpreting Article 43. It seems that constitutes an offense under, you know, one of the enumerated offenses here is being used as a term of art as well. Appellee's acts in the legal sense could not have been a violation of Article 120 Bravo because 120 Bravo did not criminalize anything until 2012. And so I think that's an additional lesson that we could get from Grace. And the final one that I would point to is the Supreme Court said that we're not comfortable with the idea that Congress would set a statute of limitations without knowing what offenses that statute of limitations applied to. And I think something else that could be said about why this is a non-absurd reason is Congress wanted to exert control and clearly specify only articles that we have defined as offenses are going to have this extended statute of limitations, and that's why we're getting rid of Article 134. That's why this is not an elements-based test, where some creative prosecutor or president in a future case can define an element, define an offense that suddenly has this massive statute of limitations. And that might be an additional reason why they cut off 134 from this extended statute of limitations. Any further questions from the court?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal.
Just a handful of points. To the inclusion of Article 120, Article 120 Bravo Foxtrot still provides for marriage to be in defense for sexual abuse of a child. So therefore, the inclusion of Article 120 is not necessarily historic, but to capture a circumstance not contemplated by Article 1, where a defense applies in Article 120 Bravo. As to United States v. Briggs, another very important part of United States v. Briggs was predictability and stability. And it is also for prosecutors and victims to know when they can bring forth their crimes. In this case, the novel application of a retroactive statute that would insert crimes that do not exist upsets that. And it also pulls the proverbial rug from underneath KR. A 10-year-old child who was sexually abused by her biological father that had to be charged under Article 134. She brought the claim within the reasonable period, within the period of time, as articulated under the statute, and therefore that stability should be honored. And Briggs tells us that. To the extent that
doesn't Briggs really just tell us, hey, don't think about it too hard, just do what the statute says? Isn't that the message, right? I mean, the court had very good, well-articulated reasons why they thought it wasn't punishable, right? Because that's what the Constitution demands. The Supreme Court said, no, don't worry about that. Just follow the statute. Isn't that what we should do here? Someone just follow the plain text of the statute.
The government will belabor the argument, all of this points. We believe that the premise advanced in our brief is asking to look at the statute. We're not asking anybody to ignore anything. To the extent, my opponents were asking you to ignore 5225 Foxtrot, the premise of the argument against for the limitation period to be curtailed is to ignore the legislative instruction manual of conforming. Public Citizen says that we can look past the naked text whenever it seems incongruent with what Congress wants. In no way you crack this nut does it come across that Congress intended this result. For those reasons, they are important. Bills should be overturned.
May I ask one question? Could you please respond to the Article 66 argument that counsel for the appellee said that even if we find that the plain error was struck on hand, so that there could be an Article 66 review?
I do
not mind enough. Who's trying to not be plain error? I
don't believe a remand would be necessary. I think that only one of the judges, Judge Salisilia, in his dissent, noted that he would not have found the error to be plain or obvious, but nonetheless he would have overturned the convictions based on broad Article 66 powers. Albeit I haven't researched that issue as premise of the Army Court's opinion, it does not appear that the other two judges felt similarly, that they believed that it was not plain and obvious, and the court was to find it as plain and obvious. Plain error just simply wouldn't apply. Plain error would not be found in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess until 10:45.